The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Chatter. I'm David Priest. This week, author Calder Walton on Russian spies in reality and fiction.
Vasily Matryokhin was the KGB's archivist, and he set his mind to the fact that he would compile a private archive of KGB records, which he would one day, hopefully, reveal to the world. Russian services today, like their Soviet predecessors, are the sort of the world's leading spy masters. But some of these staggering successes were actually owed more to the dedication of the agents than the masterful tradecraft on the part of the Soviet and Russian services. Putin's threats about using a nuclear weapon, a tactical nuke. If he does this, it's going to just fundamentally change our entire understanding of post-war international security.
Calder Walton, welcome to Chatter.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
And it's great to have you here. I've wanted you on since we've started this podcast because your work has intersected not only with some of my interests and past career, but also you do a really good job in your public conversations about intelligence history of linking it to pop culture and the popular imagination to make sure people understand the context of this thing you have made your life's work. And I really appreciate it. And it fits Chatter really well. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's really wonderful to be here. And that is that's a theme, certainly as you just said, David, of a lot of my work is intelligence in fact and in fiction. Mm-hmm. There are crossovers between the two realms, of course. But there are also major differences. So I'm afraid, from my perspective, it's not all James Bond.
That's a good thing.
Although there are some remarkable stories that you uncover in the archive that could be straight out of a novel or indeed a film.
We're going to get to all of these things in depth as we talk about the fact and fiction of spies in general, but KGB spying in particular. Mm. But I just want to pick up on that Bond thing right away, which is, it's amazing. The more I learn, even now, the more I learn about the history of the business of which I was a small part, how many things I saw in the James Bond movies growing up and other films that were just outlandish and crazy and could never happen. How much I realize, yep, you know, most of those really are absurd and ridiculous, and they might look good on screen, but they don't really match with reality in any way. And yet I discover that there are those things that I'm like, well, except for that one, right? That thing, which seemed absolutely crazy. Not James Bond splayed out on a table with a laser about to cut his crotch. Not that one. But a lot of other things I realize, wait a minute. Consciously or not, that does pull on a real story about an exfiltration or about an assassination or about a ridiculous mechanism set up for a brush pass. And there's a lot on both sides that the more you learn, the more you enjoy the other side, the fact and the fiction.
I think you've just summarized it really well. There's the two different aspects complement each other. And as long as you start watching a James Bond film knowing that it is fiction, And you can appreciate and value it for a good story. But at the same point, at the same time, some of the underlying issues that are addressed in the Bond books and the films have a kernel of truth to them. So the nature of espionage, how one person's hero is another person's traitor, the gadgets, yes, at key points in its history, we can now see that MI6 really did have laboratories where they were working on new gadgets that they could give to their officers. There really was someone called Q Quartermaster. So there are elements of truth that, of course, Ian Fleming knew. And then he wove a picture, a sort of inflated picture about the image of James Bond. He had to do it for practical reasons, that when Fleming was writing his books and the movies were coming out, it seems crazy to think of it now, and it's particularly crazy given the US perspective. Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6, didn't officially exist. The British government didn't avow its existence. Mm-hmm. So, and there were strict, the Official Secret Act meant that people who wrote about it and discussed it could be prosecuted. So Fleming, for very good reasons, he wanted to stay out of jail. had to embellish the truth when it came to MI6. But the crossover between the realm of fiction and fact, there's another side to that that I would like to, that sometimes I see historical dramas about, particularly the area that really I know best about is the British intelligence history. And they're wonderful depictions, but then for whatever reason, the director, the script writers, sometimes take it that step too far, and they add in an extra wrinkle, which isn't the reality. And I'm sometimes left just wondering, why did they do that? They didn't need to make it that much more convoluted. There's one, think it was your listeners will correct me, but it was the film about the breaking the Enigma code. Maybe it was called Enigma. Maybe it was called The Imitation Game. I can't remember off the top of my head. Right. It was probably The Imitation Game. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, they went one step so far. It was basically discussing the existence of one of the KGB spies at Bletchley Park. This was John Cairncross. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the film, they said, oh, no, actually, this was a, or they suggested this was actually a clever British plot to make Cairncross seem like he would be a triple agent. You're like, no. You don't need. I mean, actually, the stories that story and then more like it are so good that you don't. They write themselves. They are effectively made for Hollywood stories, if you like, and you don't need to then go that one step further and embellish them for whatever reason they did that.
The parallel for that, in my experience, was the film Argo, which overall was a very good film. And in large part stuck to, not entirely, but through much of the film, sticks to the basic lines of what happened. And I'll give them artistic license to drop certain details and to add a few conversations and embellishments. That's what a movie is.
The listeners can't see me at this point, but I'm sticking two thumbs up saying this is absolutely right. I mean,
the airport scene at the end just takes it in a comically bad place, and it was completely unnecessary given the magnitude of the moments right before that.
That's right. I think my yardstick for, or what I aim for with my own historical work, is to use documents to bring together a story that I hope sticks to the truth as I can establish it, but also is exciting to read. And I think that I think that Argo, as you just said, that's a really first class effort, both on the part of the CIA and the filmmakers. Yes, certainly there are elements that we can argue about, but here's the thing: if that film inspires somebody to go and read a book about it, that's great. And I've just written a review of Christopher Nolan's brilliant film, Oppenheimer.
Right. Right.
And we could perhaps post that, David, on the link to this. But my own view is that, yeah, certainly there are inaccuracies. Okay, fine. And it's the easiest thing in the world for a professional historian to take pot shots sort of thing. But the depiction and to motivate people to get interested in the history, if that film motivates people to go and pick up the biography of Oppenheimer and actually read about it, fantastic, job done. People, I think most people do have a most people do realize that when they go to see a movie as opposed to a documentary, there are going to be elements of poetic license, of artistic creativity. Right. So not everything in film or in the written word needs to be a slave to the facts. There are possibilities to get people interested in it.
I think the ultimate example of this in recent pop culture, something that broke through to the ultimate mass public, was the play Hamilton, which took great liberties with its source material in terms of form of presentation, certainly, but in other ways. And yet I understand that it led to immense sales for the biography of Alexander Hamilton written by Chernow and other examinations of Hamilton, which I call that a win.
Absolutely. That you and I were thinking along similar lines, because that was the next one I was going to say as well. Absolutely. Yeah. I agree wholeheartedly with that.
Well, let's go back a few steps, Calder, to how you got here. You mentioned your work as a historian, but you weren't, you know, born fully produced from the head of Zeus as a historian. So what's the path that got you there? I understand that obviously you're trained as a historian, but also that you worked as a barrister at one point. So please explain, first of all, to the American audience, how a barrister is and isn't just a lawyer in the American parlance. Then how you got to intelligence history as your core work.
That's right. Well, thank you for asking that. It's looking back on it now, I've been in this field of research for 20 years now. I was actually a medieval historian by training. So, you know, Latin and knights and medieval kingdoms and so on. That was my bread and butter. When I was an undergraduate, I read The Metrocan Archive by Christopher Andrew, just as for fun. You know, it was all over the newspapers, and I
give us a few words on what that is for people who don't know the story of that archive and how it came to the West and to be published.
The Metrocan Archive, the story of it is simply one of the most remarkable stories I know of about how a history book can be written. So Vasily Metrocan was the archivist in the KGB's first chief directorate. That's its foreign intelligence branch. And in the 1960s and 70s, he became, particularly after 1968 and the crushing of the Prague Spring, he became increasingly despondent with the regime that he was a part of and the agency, the KGB, that he was an archivist for. And he set his mind to the fact that he would compile a private archive of KGB records, which he would one day hopefully reveal to the world in the West. So what he started off by doing was to write down annotate and write down the records that he'd seen during his working day when he got home, remembering them. And then he realized that actually, when he was leaving the building, the archive for the first chief director, nobody was really checking him. So he started to simply take the documents home and copy them out. And this began a year-long process by which he would copy out documents and then hide them, particularly at his countryside retreat, his dacha outside of Moscow. He'd hide them in old milk churns in the garden. Well, cut a long story short, this extraordinary archive of Soviet foreign intelligence material, Metrocan saw that his moment was coming as the Soviet empire was disintegrating. And after 1991, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, he went first to the Americans, it has to be said, who you know, in fairness to the CIA, were inundated. This is somewhere, we don't exactly know which station, although I believe it was in one of the Baltic countries, inundated with requests from ostensible defectors, you know, who were willing to be selling their hitherto secrets to the CIA. So in fairness to the CIA, it was easy to overlook, but this is, I think I'm right in saying, and I probably still has some blushes on CIA officers to this day, one of the great oversights. So what did Mitrokhin do? He went down the road to the British, who were a bit more reckless, and said, this looks like an extraordinary opportunity. Cut a long story short, MI6 exfiltrated both Mitrokhin and his archive to the West, to the UK. It was of operational significance for most of the 1990s as case officers, as you can imagine, trawled through all of the leads. The FBI called it, when the FBI was indoctrinated into it, they called it, I think, the single most important source on counter-espionage ever to have come the way of the FBI. Mm-hmm. So words to that effect. And then it became the basis of two brilliant books by Christopher Ander and Vasily Mitrokhin, Volume 1 and Volume 2. So to get back to your original question, I read this in 1999 when it came out. I just thought, this is an extraordinary story.
It's mesmerizing to read. The grand scope of history, you can see play along with some of the details, but some of the details themselves are just remarkable.
That's exactly it. And again, to your point about sort of fiction, the stories write themselves, the characters who you meet along the way. Mm-hmm. So I emailed Christopher Ander and said, look, I am just blown away by this as an opportunity to do original research and would love the opportunity to work with you. Well, again, cut another long story short, that led to a master's at Cambridge and then a PhD. It must have been very early on in my master's degree, Chris Andrew was appointed to become MI5's authorized historian.
Right.
So this is something that, again, in terms of fact and fiction, something that I think really the US government is slightly missing a trick on. The UK government, for all of its history of secretiveness when it comes to its intelligence services, has been remarkably good at getting independent academic historians in to write the histories of their agencies. Yeah. And therefore revealing to the broader public what they do in fact, and then what they don't do in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. MI5 has written its 100-year history. Mm-hmm. MI6 wrote its history for the first 40 years, and GCHQ has written it exactly.
Yeah.
And I think, to be honest, I think CIA is missing an opportunity to do that, because the thing is, their history is going to get written one way or another. So the agency can either
have
help write it, or it can be written by people that are only looking to highlight abuses and failures. Anyway, to get back to your original question, when Chris Andrew was appointed MI5's official historian, he said, he asked, would I be interested in some part-time work on that history? And I was like, this is too much of an opportunity to pass up. So that led to 6 years of research, part-time research, helping to write that official history. So that really wasn't an opportunity of a lifetime, to be honest.
But thank you. Actually, I appreciate you telling that, not only because it gets us to mention Christopher Andrew and his groundbreaking work in so many subfields related to this, but also brings us to how you came to the topics you've been working on now. But you did not close the loop on the barrister side of things.
Yeah, that was it. You're absolutely right. So after I did a PhD and postdoc, I published my first book about the end of the British Empire and British intelligence, mm-hmm. Called Empire Secrets. And I'd always had an interest in the legal profession. I enjoyed the idea of being, I liked the idea of being in court, being a litigator. And in England, that means being a barrister, although solicitors, the other branch of the legal profession, are increasingly also doing that. But So I took the opportunity. I said, well, if I'm not going to do it now, I'm never going to do it. So trained, and in England, it's a much more, it's a much quicker route. You don't have to do 3 years right. Of law school, and it's far right. less expensive. I should also hasten, mm-hmm. to add. So trained as a barrister, did a pupillage, and worked for 4 or 5 years as a barrister, which I'm very grateful for the experience of doing, but I also realized that my passion doesn't lie with, I mean, some of the cases it's funny how things go full circle. Some of the cases I did involved, one Russian oligarch suing another Russian oligarch in an English court. So it's interesting how things go around. Anyway, I realized that that wasn't something that I wanted to do for the rest of my life. But instead, history is my passion. So I saw this a fellowship at the Kennedy School. I took a massive pay cut, and I've never been happier. So
it allows you to do what you want to do, and you know,
like any, I don't know if you feel the same way, David, but I feel that anyone doing what we do is, I'm basically paid to do a hobby. I would like to be doing this anyway. Talking about intelligence, reading intelligence books. So it's a wonderful area to be doing research in. There's a lot of misconceptions about it, I'm really excited about what will hopefully come next in my career.
It's one of those subfields where I feel, man, maybe I just don't know enough people studying intelligence, although I think I do.
Yeah, you do.
I'm trying hard to think of somebody who doesn't enjoy their work. That is, who doesn't find themselves just kid in a candy store about digging into archives or doing interviews. And it doesn't matter what period, it doesn't matter what slice of intelligence history it is. And maybe I'm inadvertently putting down other fields, although I'm not trying to, but I don't get the same sense that everybody is absolutely loving what they do in so many other areas as intelligence, perhaps for the reason you cited, which is you can clarify very prominent public misperceptions fairly easily with some good research in a way that, say, that's right. if you're studying, you know, medieval history, there aren't as many yeah. widespread public misperceptions that the historian is digging down and publicizing. But I think also it's the exploring the unknown. In so many fields of study, you're exploring the unknown. That's part of the enterprise. But in intelligence, it's almost working at two levels. You're discovering the unknown about what was unknown even at the time. And that yeah. makes it both a little bit harder, but a little more rewarding when you put together some materials from archives and other sources.
I think you're absolutely right, David. And I should also say that for me, as you asked my own sort of personal journey, the moment when I decided that perhaps law wasn't for me in the long term, it actually coincided. Unfortunately, my dad got very ill, and that made me think a lot about how fragile life can be, and that actually this... how important it is when at some point I'm looking back on my life and my career to do something that you feel passionate about. So that was a big motivation for me. It's funny though that increasingly what I see intelligence history, we have the happy problem of now having so many records that you barely know. I mean, you know, and you don't even need to travel like you did a while ago. You probably remember with the declassified CIA record system at the National at College Park. You used to have mm-hmm. to go there, log on to their special term. Well, now it's all on the CIA website. So even though they've rejigged the website, that's a whole separate story. It's not the most user-friendly. Anyway.
It's a lot more user-friendly than, you know, finding one of the two terminals that's available in College Park, Maryland, and hoping you'll have access during the time that it's open. It's still better than that.
It's still better than that, exactly. But what I do think is interesting, though, or what there's a resonance here, actually, of we have so many records that it's difficult to know where to begin with, but there are still mysteries within those records, the British intelligence dossiers. They are far from the complete picture. And so actually, I think that there's an element to which my training as a medieval historian is still relevant for this. Because what are we trying to do? We're trying to weave together incomplete data sets and come to some sort of overall conclusion. It's made all the more that the difference between medieval history and modern intelligence history is that, you know, you are dealing with secrets that someone somewhere has an answer to. And so there's this continual quest to sort of say, oh, maybe I can uncover what they've been deliberately trying to withhold. And of course, you don't get that in if you're studying medieval history or even other areas of modern history. There's far less motivation. You don't have to contend with the fact that there are professional weeders of records that are trying to keep particularly sources and methods out of the public domain. And that's fair enough. You know, there are things that I don't want to know about. I should not know about things that will engender current sources and methods. I don't think it's anyone's place to know that other than the professionals. But then sometimes one does read the records and you think, okay, there's inconsistency here because on one page, a name has been redacted, then there's a copy of the same record and the name's there. And you're like, oh, okay, that, why did you bother to redact that on the foot? Anyway, you know, it's an imperfect science.
Well, thank you for the background on your own story and how you got to here. You mentioned some of your previous published work, but we're speaking not long after the occasion of your publication of the, I'll call it a tome, because it is a hefty piece of work, and it is Spies, the Epic Intelligence War Between East and West. And it is a remarkable book. I have finished listening to it in its entirety as an audiobook, and I have the hard copy as well. It is and will stand as probably the standard single volume covering the history of espionage between the West and the East in the last 100 years. It really covers that scope very well. It's not all about Tolkachev or the Cambridge Five. There have been deep dives on each of them and others, but putting them all together with a framework and a theme that makes it approachable to the general reader, it really is a remarkable piece of work. So I want to compliment you on the effort that it must have taken to pull together everything that went into that. What was your biggest challenge in doing it other than pure volume?
Well, first of all, thank you, David. I think everyone, my wife and son, will be the first to say we're all very glad it's done. And it is a tome, as you said. What's the biggest challenge is how to bring this huge amount of data together. There are underlying themes that go like threads throughout it. And the problem is that any one of the cases that I looked at could quite easily have become books in themselves. And so it was a really difficult balancing act between covering what I knew was important to cover for readers so that they don't get a warped sense of the history, and at the same time not going so far down into the weeds that you lose people other than a few very niche scholars. So it was a very difficult balancing act. Mm-hmm. What's been the biggest challenge, inevitably, the closer we get to our own time, the archival records dry up. And so I was relying heavily on interviews. Mm-hmm. That's necessary, you know, that's part of the territory. But again, it's interesting in light of my own work, previous work as a barrister in court. And you know, the first thing you learn is that the people's answers depend on the questions put. Mm-hmm. And so memory, even with the best intentions, is fallible. There have been some really remarkable some remarkable studies about how people's brains work about memories and the cognitive layering the people in the witness stand will say wholeheartedly, 100%, guarantee you, the woman who was crossing the road was wearing a red dress. I was standing there. And then they're shown video footage and she's wearing a blue dress. How right. does that happen? It's right. about questions put. It's about memory. But so that, and that happens, of course, when people are recalling events from 20 years ago, 30 years ago and stuff. So I always try to ground my interviews in at least one document or have at least two different sources, mm-hmm. say, confirming, not just be one source.
And what's interesting doing that at this time, I have to say, is you've incorporated into the book things that have only been declassified and released in many cases within the last year. And that changes things. I've read books about the Cambridge Five and references to Kalinske and Gordievsky and all these people before. And yet I was learning new things because I have not been digging into all of the new material that's come out in various waves, including quite a bit in the last 4 or 5 years. And I appreciated that. So I like the fact that we're, in a sense, updating our own narratives and stories about what happened as we learn more about everything from, you know, the Rosenbergs to Alder James.
Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, it's there's now so much information that it's difficult to keep up to date and keep up to pace. I have to say, the UK National Archives, it's just for any listeners who are thinking about graduate research projects, it is they do a remarkable job of declassification and then full transparency in what they're declassifying. And a lot of the files that they declassify to do with intelligence are digitized. So one doesn't even need to travel to the National Archives in London. You can simply download them from wherever you are and work on them.
That's wonderful. And
it is. And the dossiers, you know, compared to some of the records that I from other countries that I've used, the dossiers from the early Cold War, the British ones, they are a real testament to the value of the UK civil service. They're all meticulously filed, and they tell a story. It's still sort of makes me so excited to work with them, is that it's the same files. And when if you do go there to the National Archives, it's the same files that the desk officers were using, and you can see the thumb pages, and you can see where the file was when it was taken out and who it was taken out by. So when they're investigating the Cambridge spies, you can see exactly who was looking at the file when, and you can see the underlinings, you can see the exclamation marks that someone's put in the file margins. There's also just the other thing is that it's not just these files aren't just of relevance to people studying the history of intelligence. They're also relevant to people studying social history. The intercepts of phone calls of targets of surveillance from national independence leaders in Africa through to, the usual suspects in the Communist Party, but also just a constellation of different political actors in both Britain and the Empire in the 20th century. You've got intercepted mail correspondence where they steamed open people's letters. You've got intercepted, bugged conversations. So that was another thing that I tried to do, David, that your listeners might be interested in. To get back to your original question, what was the challenge? Well, it was, if you like, packing everything in. Yeah. And then what I decided to do was to actually, some of the things that I knew were wonderful stories, but they were tangential to the main thread. I decided to build a website for the book and to put that, some of those stories and documents onto the website.
We can link to that website.
That would be great. And one of the things I put on the website in Czechoslovakian archives, the STB archives, I uncovered got released several dossiers of STB targets in the 1960s, but they included bugged conversations. So it's really really eerie. You can be teleported to conversations between two people or a couple people in a room that they thought was private. And the conversation obviously would have been lost to history otherwise. But here you are hearing the private conversations in German and in Czech between targets of STB surveillance. This is the bread and butter of what intelligence agencies do, of course, as you know. But to actually hear it is rather spooky. Let's just put it that way.
I would think it would be hard, and I think it's hard for anybody doing archival historical research, but especially given the range of things you've talked about already, it'd be really hard not to be seduced by the research. That is, to finally cut off digging in the archives and having that discovery, in some cases, page after page, transcript after transcript, and actually start writing and pulling it together. You could have been doing the research for this book literally for the next 40 or 50 years.
That's definitely true. It's also true that, three quarters of the way through, as with everyone else, when the world closed down, I was essentially halfway through the research for the book. And then we had 2 years 18 months of archival closures. And that was difficult, to put it mildly. Then coming out of that, Putin's war in Ukraine, and that transformed the tenor of the book. It made it, on the one hand, much more urgent. I wanted to bring this story out as quickly as possible. On the other hand, history was changing before our eyes each day. How finding that balance again between, I was, especially at the beginning and the end, where you write something, and then you're like, well, actually, I don't know. And the biggest thing, David, the thing that still, as with everyone, Putin's threats about using a nuclear weapon, a tactical nuke. He's threatened to do this. He was making these threats as I was writing, finishing the book. If he does this, it's going to just fundamentally change our entire understanding of post-war international security and deterrence. So it was difficult to try to write about contemporary history in such a way that it wouldn't quickly become redundant with changing world events. So,
you need not worry about that, because having just taken in your writing in audio form, I heard the many ways that links were made literally to 100 years ago, with some things having to do with Ukraine, and throughout this history of the ways in which history is echoing when it comes to Russian behavior with Ukraine, in relation to Russian intelligence and how it operates, and how we've seen that reflected in the last year plus. So I think you've done that. It's not a book about Russia-Ukraine, but it is highly relevant to anybody who's interested in getting a different perspective on the conflict through the lens of intelligence history. So we'll put that one in the positive column, because I think it did work. I do want to drill down on a couple of these cases, because and obviously we can't and won't deal with everything you've written about, but there are some prominent cases of spies working in the United Kingdom and in the United States for the Soviet Union or the Russians or both, depending on the time frame, that we have a much more complete understanding of now than we did certainly 25, 30 years ago, but even in some cases 5 or 10 years ago. So I'd ask you to briefly tell the story of a few of these, including what we now know that's different than what was certainly known at the time, or even the first draft of history as it was written. And I'd like to start with the Cambridge Five, perhaps as a unit, one of the most successful Russian penetrations of the Allies, including specifically the United Kingdom, the person of Kim Philby himself, but those around him and all of the things that they did. who were they in a nutshell, and why were they so valuable to the Soviet Union early in the Cold War?
Yeah. Well, the Cambridge Five, as you said, this has been, especially in the UK, there's been an entire industry of books written about this, and they are just, it's on the one hand, you think, surely it's all been said by now. On the other hand, the records that are coming out throw new light on this old story. So who were they? The Cambridge Five were five graduates of Cambridge University in the mid-1930s who the KGB's predecessor, the NKVD, recruited as agents and had the intention, this was unlike anything being done in the West at the time, that they would join they would take the exams to join the UK civil service and get into sensitive positions of power. The Second World War was the moment that allowed them to do what they've been planning before the war. Britain's intelligence services, desperate for new recruits, and were effectively, with hindsight, shockingly poor vetting standards. So if you knew somebody and you had a, you know, that and that, that if you knew somebody well-placed and that person said, he's a good chap, because generally it was men at that point, and you went to the right school, you had the right accent, the doors are suddenly opened. Even if there are, if there were blemishes about Marxism in your history, there's on the one hand, we can say that British security was astonishingly poor. So they didn't rely on proactive investigations into applicants' backgrounds.
And for many years thereafter, right, they continued just to see whether there was a mark against them in the files already. And if not, they were okay.
That was it. Exactly. And on the other hand, it was a very skillful matter of tradecraft by Soviet intelligence operatives to purposely distance themselves from communist organizations that would have led to those blemishes, as you said, in the records. So if you keep an arm's length from them, if you know that MI5 is looking at communist organizations in the UK in the 1930s, and you keep your distance from them, you don't join their mailing lists, you don't go to their meetings, the chances of there being a so-called trace in the records are fewer and fewer. And then if you happen to be wearing the right university tie when you go for an interview, the doors are suddenly open. So this is the story that's been relatively well. I mean, it's been well known how they managed to do this. The damage that they did to both British and US security during the Second World War, and then as the Cold War set in, is hard to overstate. The volume of intelligence that they were producing from the different branches of the UK government, and which had access to the US government as well, meant that effectively Stalin was effectively, as the Cold War descended, at key moments, he was engaged with open diplomacy with his Western counterparts, though they didn't know it. So at these key milestones, Churchill's Iron Curtain speech, the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, these big milestones that we all learn about in history lessons at school. Well, Stalin was actually receiving inside knowledge about them thanks to the Cambridge spies. Kim Philby, who you mentioned, during the Second World War, managed to become the head of the department in MI6 that was responsible for countering Soviet espionage. So just to draw a red line under that, that meant that the person in charge of catching Soviet spies in MI6 was himself a Soviet spy. I mean, history has few masterstrokes like this.
That's it's such a remarkable stranger than fiction story just because of that, and obviously the things pertaining to that were given to the Soviets. But to me, it's remarkable that other things that he had some awareness of,
yeah,
like I believe you mentioned the in Albania, was it, that there was the effort to get some operatives onto the ground in Albania and intervene. And he basically gave away the operation and locations to something that was not technically in his counterintelligence or whatever portfolio he had at the time. Yep. And yet it was, history would have been changed.
That's right. So on the level of destruction is now, I think, laid bare in the records that have been declassified. With things like, for example, the defection of a Soviet cipher clerk at the very end of the Second World War. So the Second World War is over. A defector in Ottawa in Canada from the Soviet military intelligence, GRU, Igor Gizenko, he defects, bringing with him documents revealing to Western governments what the Soviet Union had been doing against them during the war. And we can now see in the records how Philby in MI6 tries to take over the entire investigation, even though it wasn't within his jurisdiction to do so. And we know what he was really trying to do, which was to bury important information and to manipulate the investigation from the inside. It really is, the level of destruction. On the Albania, the rollback operations in Albania, there's historians are still trying to unpick exactly how those operations were betrayed, why they were failures. And I'll point listeners in the direction of the recent work by Rory Cormack. He's a brilliant historian, UK-based historian. And he's pointed out, building on the work of others, that yes, Philby almost certainly betrayed those operations, but they were also, it has to be said, rather inept in terms of security on the part of both MI6 and the CIA themselves. So recruiting loose-lipped emigre groups to then parachute back in behind the Iron Curtain, it's little, given the nature of who they were recruiting and their less than perfect security, it's not that surprising that the operations were unsuccessful. And that's a polite way of saying the agents parachuted in many cases were eliminated by Stalin's secret police.
So. And there are a lot of that. There's a repetition of that story right across the Cold War in particular of cases where the spies gave something away, but it's not clear that it would have worked anyway because of either incompetence or lack of political support or funding. But to close the book on the Cambridge Five, the one thing I came away from your retelling of the story with the new information is that I don't know how to phrase this, but it fit into a theme that I think is generally true, which is that many of the spies working for the Soviets and the Russians across decades and decades, many of the best ones, individually and collectively, were not recruited as such. Mm. That is, they weren't convinced to work, other than people like Ames and Hansen, who eventually got a lot of money, but they weren't recruited by the Russians. So many of them were people that early on for ideology and later on for cash or ego, basically volunteered and found a way to self-recruit. And it didn't take a whole lot of pushing from the Russians, which in turn tells you something about the KGB and the impression of the KGB as master spies who are able to manipulate people and get people to work for them. Maybe they're just kind of lucky that at different times for different reasons, people wanted to get information to them and they just happened to run the assets, but they weren't necessarily the geniuses making all of it happen. What have I mischaracterized there?
No, you haven't mischaracterized it at all. And that I'm so glad you phrased it that way and have asked that question, because that is certainly that is the impression that sort of just screams at you the more that you look at the history of this. So a lot of it is wrapped up in contemporary politics within Russia. So Russia's services, especially under Putin for the last two decades, have had an inbuilt tendency to valorize the past successes of Russian intelligence. Putin, of course, being a former KGB officer, you know, this is very close to his heart to valorize the past successes. And it's not difficult to see that the narrative is the Russian services today, like their Soviet predecessors, are the sort of the world's leading spy masters. But to your absolutely correct point, and what I try to weave through the book, is that some of these staggering successes were actually, in the past, actually owed more to the dedication of the agents than the masterful tradecraft on the part of Soviet and Russian services. So one of the big correctives that I make in the book about the Cambridge spies, just to close that chapter, is that within the Kremlin today's telling of the story, when Burgess, the two of the members of the network, Guy Burgess and Donald MacLean, they defected in 1951, and that suddenly that a search was on for the so-called two missing diplomats. Mm-hmm. Kim Philby, who was at that point MI6 liaison officer in Washington, D.C., he knew, which was at the, so he was at the apex of that transatlantic clandestine relationship. Philby knew that his friendship and affiliations with Burgess had previously been living with him as a lodger in Washington. He knew that proximity to Burgess would cast suspicion on himself. So what does Philby do? Well, in the Kremlin telling today, he stoically restrained himself from saying anything to British intelligence as he was subject to interrogations. Well, that's a load of, excuse my friend, bollocks, I'll say.
You found otherwise.
Yeah. We can now see that in the immediate aftermath of the MacLean and Burgess defection, what does Philby do? He writes a letter to the head of MI5 and MI6, and he effectively throws them both under the bus. This was at a moment when, just to sort of underscore it, that the British authorities didn't know where they were, didn't know what was going on. Few people had a fear. They're like, oh no, they couldn't be Soviet agents, could they? Where are they? Well, Philby writes this letter, a tissue of lies, saying, I think they're probably Soviet agents. There's good grounds. He said, you know, as his phrase was, as things have come back to me over the last few weeks, I remember some facts about Burgess as he was living with me, which suggest that he may have been a Soviet agent. And in fact, one of them may have recruited the other while at Cambridge. Well, in fact, Philby knew that he was the one who had been responsible for recruiting them at Cambridge. So what was this an effort to do? It was to deflect suspicion from himself, throw them under the bus, and to hang on. What does it mean? It means that Burgess betrayed the British. Yes, we've known that. But he also betrayed a fellow Soviet agents, something that the Kremlin doesn't want to admit today.
Yeah.
David, to your point, time and time again, the infamous Cambridge, the Soviet atom spies. Again, mm-hmm. Was it due to masterful tradecraft on the part of Soviet intelligence? Mm. I think not. I think time and time again, it's to do with the dedication of true believers, of communist true believers, who at times were throwing so much information from inside the Los Alamos Manhattan Project that their Soviet contacts could barely keep up with it. They could barely process the information that they were pushing. And then just to close the circle on this, at key points with Philby anyway, in the aftermath of the defection of Burgess and MacLean, as the search was on, what does Philby do? He reaches out for his handler in New York, his Soviet handler, desperately trying to set up a meeting. And where is the handler? Nowhere to be seen. Badly let down by Soviet intelligence. So this was all then corrected in the KGB-sponsored memoirs by Philby that were published after he eventually defected. And this has been sort of resuscitated, reinvigorated under Putin, that Soviet intelligence has been this masterful intelligence. And actually, again, you look at the British records, and the US records, it is astonishing how close British intelligence came to identifying the Cambridge spies within a whisker. Mm-hmm. And it is quite rightly remembered as the worst breach, security breach on the part of the British government in modern history. But it wasn't like they were completely and utterly blindsided. It's that they were came agonizingly close. That's the way that I would look at it.
It's absolutely fascinating that one interview that would have taken place earlier, or one additional question during an interview that did take place, could have opened it up much earlier, and it didn't happen. Of course, that as a historian, you're counterfactualizing there, but also the cases that were caught and the fact that sometimes it was that one interview or that one question that did expose something, and you can play out, well, what if that person hadn't been through that process?
And that's a really important point, because I think there's a parallel, David, with your previous profession and what historians do. So to my mind, good history tries to take people inside the decision-making at that time as they were looking forward, right? So from the perspective of people, actors at the time, as the Cold War was setting in, obviously this isn't guided by hindsight. They didn't know what had happened. They had numerous future alternatives, which have been now lost to history. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly the same, it seems to me, when we analyze intelligence failures. It all, of course, how could people have been so foolish not to connect the dots? Well, actually, at the time, there were hundreds of other dots that looked like they were even more blindingly obvious.
Yep.
And it's only with hindsight,
yep,
that the dots make sense. Hmm. So I think that that's a really... that's something I strive for in researching history, and I think it's an important parallel there when people are analyzing intelligence failures, that the mm-hmm. sort of the characterization of just connecting the dots often betrays how events looked at the time to those that were having to grapple with those
absolutely. Decisions.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
Absolutely. Calder, I do want to ask you about a case that is connected to the Cambridge Five. And it's probably the case that if you ask the average American who paid attention in a history class in high school, maybe took a history class in college, but not on intelligence history or perhaps even foreign policy, but just U.S. political history, the one case that probably would pop up is the Rosenbergs, because the case of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg is one that fits into a narrative as it's taught in American schools. But we now know something differently than the mindset as it was certainly when I grew up and afterwards. So were Julius and Ethel Rosenberg first, were they helping the Russians and the Soviets? Secondly, were they actual assets of the Russians? And how do you feel as a historian, having dug into it and seen all of the recent information about the punishment that Julius and Ethel received?
Great question. Thank you for asking that. So on the first question, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, were they Soviet assets? Yes. They unambiguously were. Julius Rosenberg was more important, it seems, than his wife, Ethel Rosenberg. We know this, David, from the so-called Venona decrypts, which is a series of communications decrypted by the US government and the UK government in the early Cold War. These are wartime documents, Soviet documents. And they reveal that Julius Rosenberg was indeed a Soviet agent. He had a code name. The role that Ethel Rosenberg played is far more difficult to pin down. It doesn't appear that she had a Soviet code name.
And that is important, right? Because we do know from Venona and other archival sources that giving a code name did matter in the Soviet system.
That's right. We should also hasten to add that I forget the exact proportions, but there are still a significant amount of Venona decrypts that have not been decrypted. So does her potential code name exist in those? Possible. I think it's only fair to say that. But certainly her significance to atomic espionage has not been confirmed or revealed any further by documents that were made available in the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So the headline that I would stress for listeners to take away is that her role was ancillary to Julius Rosenberg's. He was unambiguously a Soviet agent who knew what he was doing and was helping to funnel atomic secrets to the NKVD, to the Soviet intelligence. How does then this make me feel about what happened to them? Well, I follow here the work of the remarkable work by John Earl Haynes and Harvey Clare, two of the best historians about Venona and American communism. And they make the point in their various books that if it's a tragedy in many ways, on so many different levels. Mm-hmm. The US government knew from the Venona decrypts that Julius Rosenberg was guilty, that he was a Soviet agent. The US government couldn't produce that information in court.
Exactly.
So they had to find other ways of doing that through cross-examination, tripping them up. And this was true of the Rosenbergs and true of other Soviet agents. If in a different world, if the Venona decrypts had been made available at the time, would the Department of Justice have pushed for the harsh sentence against Ethel Rosenberg? Probably not.
Right.
But they threw everything at them, with the result that, as we learn in history books, that they were executed. Reading their pleas for clemency in the files at the Eisenhower Library still sends shudders down my spine. It's a tragedy on so many different levels. It's a tragedy because Julius Rosenberg was definitely a Soviet agent. There are serious questions about the role of Ethel Rosenberg. What would the Department of Justice have pushed for such a harsh sentence? Pushed for the death penalty in circumstances where the Venona decrypts could have been made available? I think probably not. So it's a tragedy. That's how I've come to see it. But certainly reading the transcripts, David, of the pleas and Ethel Rosenberg's letters to Eisenhower, it really is horrendous.
Let's talk about a case, the other side, which is a Soviet spy for the West. And I'm thinking here one great case that people don't know the story of. Again, most people in America hear about the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's the one thing people hear more than anything else. The closest we've been to nuclear Armageddon in the world. Got it. But the role of Oleg Penkovsky is usually overlooked in the first histories and sometimes even in the slightly more in-depth histories. So briefly, who was Penkovsky? How did he come to work against the Soviets? And why was he at least important, if not crucial, to how the Cuban Missile Crisis played out?
Well, Oleg Penkovsky, within the specialized literature, has been known about for a long time. But as you said, it's strange that his role in history hasn't really permeated the more popular culture. It's a story that has everything. It has bravery, it has betrayal, it has ultimately death because he was caught and executed. His story has been portrayed recently in the film The Courier. He's depicted by Benedict Cumberbatch. It's a good film. I recommend it. Again, to our earlier conversation, David, there's some inaccuracies in it. That's fine as far as I'm concerned. It's a film. If it inspires people to read a book about him, all the better. Oleg Penkovsky was a senior officer in Soviet military intelligence, the GRU, who had access to information about the Soviet arsenal. He was motivated by, it's difficult to unpack his actual motivations. He was motivated by a disgust for the Soviet regime that he was part of. He was also, it's fair to say, his own career probably stalled, and that he wanted to advance his career. He was perhaps thinking about life in the West, and he was also motivated by money. He was a playboy, by all accounts, as well. So he was certainly had multiple affairs going on at the same time.
He's a complicated human being, right?
He was a complicated human being.
White hat, black hat, and sometimes people are people.
That's exactly it. I think it never have more true words been said when whoever it is that said that defectors are often defective. And that certainly, let's just, as you said, in a very neutral, polite term, he was a complicated individual. But the intelligence he had, the information he had access to, from deep inside the GRU archives, became extraordinarily valuable, first to the British intelligence service, MI6, and then to the CIA, as the world came closer to the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was actually arrested by the KGB at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So scholars have debated a lot about his actual role within the Cuban Missile Crisis. But the thing is, if you look at the U.S. intelligence assessments about Soviet weapons in Cuba, those assessments that were given to JFK and his ex-com circle, the National Security Council, during those 13 days of the crisis, as the world stood at the brink of nuclear Armageddon, all of the most important assessments have a code name at the top, and the code name is Ironbark, and that's the code name for Penkovsky's intelligence. So, in other words, and this is, and David, you know more about this being at the coalface of this. One small little code name, easy to overlook in the records, actually symbolizes a colossal intelligence collection and analysis program below the surface. So that Ironbark code name was the code name for the information that he had spirited out of GRU archives. That information, including technical specifications about Soviet missiles, meant that when, as we all remember from history, when the U.S. government through the CIA's spy plane, the U-2, eventually photographed Soviet missiles in Cuba, the photo analysts were able to cross-reference what they were seeing in the photographs against the information that was available from Penkovsky's intelligence, Ironbark. And actually that stamp at the top of the assessments given to JFK, it was a sort of saying, this has been cross-referenced against the gold standard that we have it from our spy on the inside. So whatever story, whatever, and historians have debated about the actual role, his motivations, what was he trying to do, that the reality is that those key documents were all assessed against his intelligence. One of the things that didn't, though, that I think, again, if you like, Penkovsky is not really well known within the history books when it comes to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Although when I went back and watched the film on the Cuban Missile Crisis, 13 days, what's striking, yep, David, is that the beginning of the film, they actually say, we know from Ironbark, which is a very,
very specific
technical
reference.
Very specific reference. And I think most people, most viewers of the film would just like would just pass them over and be like, okay, whatever. And it's only now, and like actually they were really onto it where they knew it. But here's the thing that I think is important, and this is a picture that's far from complete, and I'm really laying the challenge down to other scholars. But the role of signals intelligence, NSA, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, I've done my best to sort of illuminate newly available records about the role of signals intelligence during the Cuban Missile Crisis, not least using NSA's declassified in-house histories. But it seems to me that actually a lot of the emphasis that the CIA placed on Penkovsky may have been an effort by the broader U.S. intelligence community to try to get the message out that the U.S. intelligence community was actually providing valuable information to Kennedy. It came from human intelligence, Penkovsky, but I wonder whether the emphasis placed on Penkovsky was somewhat of a camouflage, also to reveal in all but name other sources, in other words, technical intelligence collection from NSA.
Right.
And the role of NSA SIGINT during the Cuban Missile Crisis is a field and a subject that I think deserves a lot more attention going forward.
It's absolutely amazing that something that has been so studied and restudied still has areas for deeper exploration. It's remarkable.
Well, the best thing that we have in our favor is that bureaucracies and clandestine bureaucracies tend to be very apprehensive about letting their documents out. Right. And so actually we find that time and time again. And it's especially true, it seems to me, with the signals intelligence technical areas of technical intelligence collection, where lo and behold, here's a formerly classified history of the Cuban Missile Crisis that talks all about signals intelligence. Oh, that would have been really nice to know about 30 years ago or something. So it's going to be the gift that keeps giving, it seems to me.
A couple of other more recent cases that seem to fit into this theme of the Soviets and then the Russians not being the master spy geniuses, but in a sense being more reactive and perhaps lucky. I think about the cases of Rick Ames at CIA and Robert Hansen at the FBI, who, Rick Ames needs some money and offers up some information to the Russians and then decides, once I've gone down that road, I'm not going back, and keeps doing it. And the Russians handle him, but there's nothing magical in the way they do it. And then even more so in the Hansen case, and Hansen, of course, died recently in Supermax prison for what he did. But Hansen's case, he was essentially his own handler. He didn't allow the Soviets to give him their equipment. He didn't allow them to tell him where to do dead drops or anything else. He was basically running himself because he knew both the Russian and the American side of counterintelligence pretty well. And in both of those cases, absolutely devastating for not only American national security and Western security, but also for a whole bunch of assets in the Soviet Union, but not necessarily shining moments for Russian intelligence in terms of identifying, spotting, assessing, developing, and recruiting good sources. These were cases that just dropped into their lap, right?
That's right, which fits within the narrative that we've already been talking about. I think it's absolutely right. I think in the later memoirs of both Rick Ames and Robert Hansen's KGB handler, he tries to suggest that, I think it's Rick Ames, had actually an ideological affinity for Russia. That's a load of nonsense. These were mercenary operatives interested in their own ego, motivated to have a lifestyle that they didn't have, and earning some money, and to do as they saw, to do one over, get one better than other people in their agencies, whose careers were doing better than theirs was. So this is, again, like the Cambridge spies, devastating for U.S. National security. It's a parallel with the Cambridge spies in the case of Britain. But it also, the thing that becomes so clear looking at this history is that there's the initial damage, collateral damage of secrets that a mole, Rick Ames or Robert Hansen in the FBI, had access to, and then trying to understand the damage done. But then there's the longer term chilling effect, it seems to me, on agencies and the Bureau. So what does it say for colleagues, people who thought they were friends with these people, that they were in fact betraying all of them? And it also leads to very real cases where innocent people were accused of being Russian spies. I'm thinking of the case of Brian Kelly, a CIA officer who was accused of being a Russian spy, who turned out to be Robert Hansen. Brian Kelly's went through hell in terms of his own career in the CIA. From what I gather, he never carried a grudge and understood that this was the inherently awful reality of working in the espionage and counter-espionage world. So that's a long way of saying the significance of these cases, as with the Cambridge spies before, is not just about the granular intelligence betrayed, secrets betrayed to Moscow. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. about then the collateral damage on people's faith in their agencies and their recruitment capabilities. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So building on this theme of and you can go back to, you know, Czechists and NKVD and perhaps GRU and KGB and now SVR and FSB. I think we've hit all the letters.
Yeah.
The fact that there's not a lot of evidence of, certainly not prolonged, consistent genius level work here, that a lot of it is chance and taking advantage of opportunities, but not this master spy narrative. Why is it then that so much popular fiction does seem to build on this theme? And I don't care if it's to some degree a Graham Greene, John le Carré novels.
Yeah.
Certainly a show like The Americans on FX certainly portrayed this much more two steps ahead of everyone else. The chessboard being planned out, having people in place who are exceptionally skilled at what they do. That makes for good narrative and good fiction, but it also seems to portray the Soviets and Russians as much more powerful than they are, doesn't it?
I think that's right. I'm afraid, Dave, I haven't got a good answer to this, of why this public perception is this way. There's something, first and foremost, there's something I think within Russian DNA that makes Russians both love the world of espionage and good storytellers about it. And there's also a tendency in the West, particularly in Hollywood, that in any narrative, we need a good baddie, don't we? Good baddie, a baddie, a bad baddie. and that the Russian services, you know, fit the bill, given their past crimes. I think one of the things that we talked at the beginning of our conversation about the Mitrokhin archive and how that revealed KGB crimes to the world. The thing that I've tried to correct in this book is, you know, one can be forgiven for thinking if you read the Mitrokhin archive that its tentacles went everywhere, but actually, what were Western services doing about some of those self same operations? So that is the big corrective that I think I've tried to write with this book. Mm-hmm. Is that, yes, formidable. And the thing is, we're effectively arguing or debating about how Russia got to its end results of some extraordinary successes. So stealing the Soviet atomic bomb, the plant, the secrets of the atomic bomb, that changed history. That is clear as day, one of the most remarkable successes in espionage history. But what we're debating about is how the route by which they did so. Was it through tradecraft, or was it through, as you say, like opportunity of running with agents that presented themselves? So there's a subtle and important nuance there. But we also don't want to forget the big picture. So Russia's services, past and present, have been absolute masters of disinformation.
Right.
They had entire industries churning out disinformation that they knew exactly how the levers to pull on in Western audiences, of the kind of wedge issues in Western audiences, in the US race relations during the later Cold War, and then closer to our own time in the digital age, it continued to be race relations, Brexit and Britain, these wedge issues. Russia, past and present, has known how to exploit them. But that in itself, disinformation, isn't a good example of a bit more nuance being needed, because if you simply look at the volume of disinformation produced, the levers of power that they were playing, one could be forgiven, as indeed after 2016, when it was revealed about Russian electoral interference in the US presidential election, that Putin is this master puppeteer playing people on the world stage. And I think it's a bit like, it's the same nuance of understanding past successes with espionage as we need that with understanding disinformation. If you simply look at the volume of production, you don't ask the much more difficult question, which is, what difference did it actually make? And inherently, Dave, the problem with that is why most people don't want to ask that, is that it's basically impossible to answer. We will probably be debating for the rest of my life the exact impact that Russian electoral interference, Russian disinformation, had on the 2016 election. It's unambiguous, clear as day, that Putin ordered a active measures campaign to promote the candidacy of Donald Trump and to undermine that of Hillary Clinton. Did that effort sway the election? I fear that's just going to be impossible to answer one way or the other.
It's so largely unknowable, just because how can you determine it objectively from the outside when most people can't objectively determine what was the defining factor in their own vote, right? Because so exactly. Many things feed on each other, create narratives, create stories. You have actual memories, as you pointed out earlier, of things that didn't exactly happen the way you think they happened. All of that is built into a decision to vote, and multiply that by 100 million. That creates a whole lot of uncertainty in the variables.
That's exactly it. But that is the inherent, to get back to a word that you used earlier. That's what makes this subject so seductive and so interesting to study. Is that there are layers of, you have, on the one hand, you know that an operation took place, be it Soviet espionage in the atom bomb project or Russian active measures campaign targeting the 2016 election and the 2020 election, be it May. But then within that, then there's a layer, shades of gray as to what the actual effect of both of those were. And that's where I think it gets really interesting.
Another difference that you highlight at a few points in your most recent book that I think is not well understood is that the United States, and I would include here the United Kingdom and other allied countries, do one thing in their intelligence operations and their entire enterprise that is considered very important. It is, why do you collect intelligence? So that you can analyze it and provide assessments to policymakers that help them make tough choices in a difficult and uncertain environment. That's the whole point. You don't collect intelligence for its own sake. You collect it so it can be acted upon by policymakers. The Soviet Union, and seemingly to some extent the Russians also, had a different approach to analysis. Personnel is policy. And I think you highlighted the fact that at one point there were around a dozen intelligence analysts in the KGB when the United States alone had many thousands across several agencies. And that analysis traditionally in the Soviet sense, we have some indication from Soviet and Russian sources that analysis was very much doing what is anathema to Western intelligence services, which is telling policymakers what they want to hear, not what they need to hear. Talk through that a bit.
Well, it seems to me it all stems from the nature of the regimes that in one-party states, in the Soviet Union under Stalin, for example, his military and his intelligence officers had the very, very, very real fear for their lives. So in the pre-war years, there was Stalin instigated the Great Terror, mass purging and liquidations of his military and intelligence officers. So this was, to put it politely, to put it sort of flippantly, not an environment in which an intelligence, this wasn't going to engender a situation where an intelligence officer was willing to challenge the views of Stalin. That's putting it tritely, to say the least. This, although to a lesser degree in the subsequent years, this continues on under different Soviet leaders. That the KGB's purpose was, even in the later Soviet period, to provide quote unquote loyal information or patriotic information that confirmed rather than challenged the worldviews of the Politburo.
Right.
That's not to say that the KGB didn't have in its files and didn't provide more robust analysis, particularly in the later period, than other elements of the Soviet bureaucracy, but it was still confined within as part of the system that it was a part of. And we see, it seems to me, Putin's regime is really a throwback to, in many ways, the Stalinist regime. And we saw this, Putin's attitude and the way that he viewed foreign intelligence as clear as day before the invasion Russia's invasion of Ukraine, where there was this bizarre, if you remember, this bizarre National Security Council meeting that Putin had. And it was televised for the whole world to see. It was also pre-recorded, as people were pointing out, because people's, if you remember, watches were showing different times. But at any rate, one of the...
Was this the public dressing down of the official?
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. This was the public dressing down of his director of foreign intelligence, the SVR, Sergei Naryshkin. It was pre-recorded, but Putin decided to keep this public dressing down in the pre-recorded broadcast, which is telling. Who knows what was going on behind the scenes that led to Putin doing that. But I think it's a safe guess to say that obviously Naryshkin had said something, done something to piss off Putin. Did he provide a more sober assessment, saying that actually the invasion of Ukraine is going to be a much more difficult thing than perhaps you are banking on? Who knows? We'll know that maybe one day through a defector or through records, a new Matryokhin, you know, we can only hope
right.
for from within the regime. But the point is, looking at that episode, it seems so clear that the same crippling sycophancy that we can see in Putin's court and what he demands of his intelligence officers, that fits within a long tradition going back to the Soviet period. So we seem to have this, a really striking throwback to the Stalinist period. Again, those of us that sort of Russia watching this unfold over the preceding years, one thing that was so clear was actually, and the trajectory of Putin's regime, one thing that was so striking was how Stalin re-entered into the narrative in the Russian history books. So it's really a bizarre thing that the SVR director, who we just mentioned, Naryshkin, also is the director of Russia's Historical Society. So pretty messed up, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So that's like the CIA director being the head of the American Historical Association or something. But what you saw on the in the preceding years, especially as the SVR approached its 100-year anniversary, is that the hagiography, the pamphlets that they produced, embellishing its past successes. What you found is that some of Stalin's phrases were re-entering those periodicals, those publications, in a way that wouldn't have happened 5 years, 10 years before under Putin. So that was a real trajectory of alarm for those of us that were watching it closely.
Right. In terms of these fictional representations of Soviet and Russian spying, have you seen any that stand out to you as particularly good? I mean, I know some are wildly entertaining, from the fantastical to those, but not the representations of real world events like Oppenheimer or Bridge of Spies type things, but actual fictional representations like the Americans. Are there any that you find are rising above the others in terms of either their representations of reality or their clever use of real world events?
Oh, you already mentioned, David, the Americans. And I think it's a really fantastic series. It really takes audiences inside a semi-fictionalized or fictionalized life of Russian illegals. And the thing is, of course, the plot lines are made up and so on and so forth. But those operatives really did exist, and they do exist. And if that, again, to your point, if that motivates people to go and read about the Russian deep cover illegals network that was uncovered in the US in 2010, codenamed Operation Ghost Stories. So Gordon Carrera has a fantastic book about that. Highly recommend that. Or other deep cover illegals that operated in the West in the earlier period of the Cold War. I'd recommend the book by Trevor Barnes called Dead Doubles. So if that series, The Americans, which is a Hollywood treatment, but they had some fantastic advisors on the show. And there are elements of tradecraft there that are absolutely accurate, even if the overall storylines are embellished and Hollywood.
I'll take your point there that the tradecraft, and of course, just the, is there a word called historicity? Because there should be, but the way in which everything in the background, the television programs, the books, the clothes, the hair, they do a good job of putting it in period. It is shocking that, you know, just the pure body count, the number of people assassinated by, mauled by, tortured by this couple just in the first couple of seasons easily overtake the number actually done across any deep cover network in the United States in all of history. I mean, you compare the actual network that was wrapped up that you're talking about with the Ghost Stories book. Nothing close to what happens with this couple here.
No, that's absolutely right. And again, though, I would take my yardstick is if it gets people motivated to go read about it or to listen to them,
I'll take it.
That's job done. Exactly. Yeah. So I'm not one of these ones to sort of take pot shots at the historical accuracy of, I think when you're watching a show on FX or whatever, you know, you know that this is a dramatization, you know that this is, not supposed to be a documentary. So that, I really enjoyed The Americans, I have to say, even though there are, of course, bits of it that sort of made me go, you know, why did you have to do that? Your other, I mean, although it's not a movie depiction, but in terms of books, fictional book, to my mind, Graham Greene novels, I just go back to them time and time again. And the way that he talks about intelligence and depictions of characters, this is somebody who was an intelligence officer, and his turn of phrase in terms of wonderful literature to read, I just think you can't do better than Graham Greene.
John Le Carré gets all the attention, but Graham Greene relatively should get more attention. I'll just leave it that way.
I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah. I mean, in terms of just beautiful writing, I think you can't do better than Graham Greene.
Yeah. Well, our tradition is to end with a question from our so-called chatterbox.
You told me this is okay. Now we're going to really get going.
There we go. We'll see what it coughs up for us. Calder, you've actually done this already a few times, but okay. Who is someone in your field or a related one whose work more people should be following? Your chance to shout out a colleague.
I think it's not fair because I think she already does have a good following. And it's not fair to phrase it like that, but somebody who I have the most, I'll slightly rephrase the question if I may, which is who's somebody who you have a great admiration for, and that's Amy Zegart. And I think she's an extraordinary scholar. And every time she writes anything in The Atlantic, I pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. Her book Spies, Lies and Algorithms, I think it's called, is really the primer on how open source intelligence is changing the nature of intelligence and national security in real time at this moment. It's not fair to say that more people should pay attention to her because people already are paying attention to her, and quite rightly so. So Amy, somebody who I have just the greatest respect for.
Happy to have that recommendation for everyone. Calder, thanks for being so generous with your time. I know it's a very busy time for you right now, and it was very kind of you to make time for us to chat. Thank you.
It's been absolutely my pleasure. It's been wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter at @ThatWasChatter.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.